I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School Podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. COVID Bryant.
What?
Do you want me to intro you like that, Chuck?
Well, I guess the cat's out of the bag. Yeah, we wanted to start this episode off with a PSA. I have COVID, everybody. And the reason I'm making this so public is a couple of reasons. One, to remind everyone that we're not out of the woods yet. I'm vaccinated fully. This is almost 100% likely the Delta variant. There's no way to prove that because I've done a lot of research. They're only testing for variants in like specific places, then using statistics to like blow that out to the whole. But it is it just like this week, it was breaking news that it dropped from about 90% the vaccine effective to 64% against the Delta variant.
Yeah. I mean, that alone would make me suspect that's what it is.
Yeah. And it's the most dominant strain. It's the most likely to bust the vaccine. I went out of town over the weekend with friends and like 40% of that group have COVID now. So, and they were vaxxed. So,
oh my gosh.
It is no joke, everyone. We're not out of the woods. Please keep taking it seriously. Please get vaccinated if you haven't. And if you can use this, I know we're probably preaching to the choir mainly, but if you can use this example to try and convince someone you love to get vaccinated that is hesitant, then that's why I'm saying this.
Well, Chuck, I know Jerry would never come on and say this, but we're very, very glad that you're doing okay. and we love you very much. We're very proud of you, Chuck.
Jerry doesn't express herself emotionally like that.
No, she doesn't.
Not like you do.
No. I'm well known for that kind of thing.
But the good news and the final reason I mention it is also get vaccinated because it is doing at least part of its job in that I had a couple of days of feeling pretty bad with a cold. And have had 4 days now of feeling pretty good. And it is doing its job and keeping it very mild. And I tick off a couple of categories where if I wasn't vaccinated, it may not be so mild.
Yeah.
You know?
That's why you're L-U-C-K-Y. You ain't got no alibi. You lucky.
All right. Well, now we can talk about some not so lucky young women.
That's true. Hats off to you for that PSA, too, by the way.
Sure,
also,
thanks.
I never finished, Chuck. There's Jerry Jerome Roland over there.
Right, right.
This is Stuff You Should Know.
That's right.
So now you can take over my former duties of introing the episode.
Well, I mean, it's just funny. This is another, not funny, but I feel like we are diving more and more into sort of the horrors of not only just the workplace, but I feel like we've covered a lot more over the past couple of years, these situations in America's history where corporations have tried to just bury things that made them look bad at the expense and the lives of people that work for them.
Yeah, we've been examining how terrible life is without government regulations.
That's right. Another PSA.
It's true. And like you said, we're talking about some unfortunate women who were gravely mistreated, in part because of like the place and time that they occupied, but also because they were women, and because there were, again, no workplace safety laws or anything like that. But they, despite, you know, everything that was stacked against them, including things like their gender, they basically rose up and established some of the first successful lawsuits against employers for basically workplace abuse, or at the very least, workplace dereliction of duty of the employer to look out for worker safety. I think that's the technical way to put it.
Yeah, and, you know, we're talking about the Radium Girls, and there was a movie about this. It's not we loved the hundreds of emails about the ghost of, how do you pronounce it again?
The Brotherhood of the Beast.
Brotherhood of the Wolf.
That's right.
Was the name of the movie. And apparently
the
I'm the only
Chez-Vaudan.
Yeah, the only person who has never seen that movie.
Yeah, same here. Same here. Like, I think we are the only two. I can't remember getting more emails about a single thing than that one.
Yeah, they're literally still coming in. And I do remember once I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, I know that movie a little bit, but I didn't know the story. But there was a Radium Girls movie from 3 years ago that I sort of half watched today. I don't want to disparage anyone, because filmmakers tried to get the word out about an important event in history, but I'll just say that the RogerEbert.com website gave it 1.5 stars, and that's the only thing I'll say.
Out of how many stars?
100.
Wow.
It was not very good.
You got a 1.5%. That is wow. No. Yeah, I did not watch that one. I haven't read the book yet either, but one of the problems with taking up something like this is, like, it was the same thing with Henrietta Lacks when we did our episode on HeLa cells, where it's really hard to kind of dig past the wall of journalism surrounding, like, the release of a popular book.
Yeah.
And anything that is written in that book and that book's take on the story, all of that stuff basically becomes it. Like, that's it. That's just that's this person said this, and this person played this role. And you know, it just becomes like the story, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Fortunately for Radium Girls, and I'm not taking away from Kate Moore's book at all. From everything I've seen, it was extremely well researched, and, like, it did a really great job of bringing this to the forefront too.
Yeah.
But fortunately, there's also, like, a lot of scholarship that was written and researched before that still exists on the internet. So you can kind of, like, get into some other details too, besides, well, the book said this and the book said that. And then also, fortunately, we had our buddy Dave Ruse help us out with some research too.
And Dave hates books.
He does. He's always burning books.
No, Dave, in fact, is the one that said we should definitely mention Kate Moore's 2017 book, The Radium Girls, colon. That we should have a sound effect for colons now.
What if we had, like, one of those in-studio choruses that go, colon, or colon?
That'd be great.
Okay.
We need a barbershop quartet.
Yeah, that'd be good.
The Radium Girls, insert sound effect, The Dark Story of America's Shining Women.
Yes.
I'm not sure if I like that pun, but yeah.
Not one, but two puns. The Dark Story of America's Shining Women.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah. So the whole thing about Radium and the Radium Girls, and that's what the press dubbed them, they also, I believe, called themselves the Society of the Living Dead, which is some pretty serious gallows humor, considering, like, the state and shape that they were in. They kind of came out of this era where radium, like the 19-teens, the early 1920s, the first Radium Girls, there are actually two sets, as we'll see. But they came out of this era where was there three?
Yeah, there was another factory that we're not even going to have time to talk about.
Okay. Well, let's say what decade was that one?
I think it was the same decade. I think it was just another factory that, you know, we just can't do a two-hour show.
I gotcha. So they, we're well on our way already, Chuck. but they existed in an era where radium was seen as this thing that was just this amazing cure-all tonic, a wonder of nature that was put in all sorts of different products, from cigarettes to condoms to, there was a water called Radithor that was irradiated water, that radioactive water that you would drink to get the radioactivity in your body because it was, you know, thought to give you like health, energy, vitalization, cure all sorts of diseases. It said that it bathed the stomach in liquid sunshine. And all of this was pretty new stuff because it wasn't more than two decades before that Marie Curie and Pierre Curie discovered radium in the first place back in 1898.
Yeah, I mean, they discovered it, and I think they even named it. I think Latin radius means ray, and they knew that it emitted rays of energy even at that time. And, you know, or very early on, they started using radiation to try and help treat cancer. Like, hey, let's put this in a lead box and cut a hole in it, and then put that hole over the human body, like aiming it toward where a tumor might be, like very obviously rudimentary stuff.
And you have to make a pew, 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 right. Pew, pew sound the whole time. That was kind of one of the roles of the technician at the time.
That's right. And you should have seen the audition tapes.
Some people had zero rhythm. It'd be like, pew, pew.
Like, sorry, pew, you're well qualified, pew. But... So Curie, actually, she died in 1934 from aplastic anemia, which is a bone marrow disorder. Mm-hmm. Caused by radiation exposure. So they knew that it was dangerous. And, but it was still like you said, it was in the, you know, it was known as a cure for the living dead in that Radithor water.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, basically used for everything from gout to fatigue. And it was just one of those crazy times in American history where now we look back and we're like, this is just nuts. But yeah, back then they didn't know.
Well, so there were two tacks from what I could tell. There was the beginnings of academic scholarship, and both of the Curies had some sort of suspicion. And there was this idea that there was easily you could be exposed to too much. You didn't want to have too much radium, but a little bit was good for you. But then there was also this academic tack that was like, no, this stuff might not be good at all. Like, we should really be careful with this. But the popular idea of it that you would read in the newspapers or, you know, maybe even what your doctor thought about it, all came from radium research that was almost exclusively underwritten and in a lot of cases carried out by companies that made their money off of radium. Like, they were just touting this stuff as an amazing wonder element, basically. And so there was like almost these two overlapping worlds that weren't connected at the time in our understanding of radium in like the 19-teens and 1920s.
Right. So one of the other kind of cool and interesting things about radium is that it can make things glow in the dark. Mm-hmm. And glow in the dark is very sort of like, who cares now? It's still kind of fun. But in the 1920s, glow in the dark was a very big deal. It was basically the future and kind of space age. And if you had a glow in the dark watch or a glow in the dark clock, then you felt pretty cool, basically, because you could see that thing in the dark. And so, of course, these companies wanted to start painting watch faces and clocks with radium. And they got young women and sometimes even girls as young as like 14 years old to do this stuff.
Yeah. I think the first company, at first they were working on military clocks and military dials, like you might put in an airplane or something. And the first company, I think, that was established to do this was United States Radium back in 1916 in New Jersey, Orange, New Jersey, I think. And like you said, they hired young girls, very, very young girls. I think the oldest one I saw by far was 28. But for the most part, they were in their teens to early 20s. And this was like a really big deal job, like that was very highly paying. I think they were in the women who painted radium or watch dials with radium paint were in the top 5% of earners in America at the time. And this was a factory job.
Yeah.
And then also it was prestigious too, from what I saw.
Yeah, the movies and, you know... God, I don't know if it's accurate or not. I'm going to say what the movie said. The movie said that they were paid a penny per face, and a high earner could crank out 200 a day, so that's about $2 a day.
Okay.
So,
but that's like $1 million today, I think. That's also what the movie said.
Well, $1 million, double that, and that's about what a gram of radium cost in today's dollars, that is. I think it was like 100 grand a gram. Yeah. In the 1920s for a gram of radium.
So they were themselves highly paid, but they also were working with what was at the time the most expensive material on Earth. And it makes sense that it would be so expensive. Like, radium is really rare. It's super radioactive, but it's really, it occurs in very small amounts, which kind of lets you realize how radioactive it is. That, you know, it's a daughter isotope of uranium, whereas uranium decays, one of the things that it becomes is radium. And in uranium ore, I think the Curies, when they first discovered radium, they found that after they took uranium out of this ore, pitchblende, which we talked about in the uranium mining episode, that the pitchblende was still radioactive. So, like, what else is in here? And out of 10 tons of uranium ore, they managed to extract 1 milligram. So it would make sense, especially at the time, that it would cost a couple $1 million for a single gram of that stuff.
Yeah, and so these girls and young women were... this stuff was getting in their hair. It was getting on their clothes. It was sort of a badge of honor because you would go out that night dancing or something and you would glow a little bit. They would even purposefully put it on their teeth sometimes. They were called ghost girls. And it wasn't a fad in that it was widespread because only a select few like had their hands on it. But I think that's one of the reasons the girls like these jobs is because they could go out and like attract attention because they had this glow in their hair and on their dresses.
Yeah, I think also people knew that they were working with radium, and radium at the time was like Missy Elliott mixed with ecstasy back in the late 90s, like as cool as
what?
It got, you know
oh,
what
wow.
I mean?
Goodness.
Yeah, thanks. I'm just trying out some new stuff. How's it going?
It's good. In fact, I think maybe we should take a break. I need to re-examine that analogy so I can really fully grasp it.
All right. You just let it sink in, buddy.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Chuck, I got to say before we start back again, you don't seem like you have COVID. Are you faking?
I'm not faking. I am a little spacey, though.
You're doing great. I mean, you've researched an episode of Stuff You Should Know, probably the most challenging podcast on the planet.
Yeah, sure.
And you're presenting it like just like an ace. So hats off to you again.
Well, thanks, man.
You got it. So you were saying before that the Radium Girls were covered in radioactive dust.
Yeah.
And they were, because they would mix their own paint. And they worked with a specific kind of paint called Undark. It was a proprietary blend where they would mix some, they would basically mix it with water and a little bit of solvent and create their own paint from this radium dust. So radium dust was like all over the place, which is bad enough. You know, you can get pretty radioactive from being exposed to radium dust like that. But it was far, far worse in those working conditions because they were actually ingesting the radium through the paint as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, if you think this already sounds like a workplace violation, this is where it just gets bonkers, because mm-hmm. they would actually, you know, if you're painting a 1 millimeter wide number on a watch, and I think the watch faces themselves were like 3.5 centimeters, mm-hmm. you have to have a tiny little point on the end of that paintbrush. And painters know one way you can achieve this is something called lip pointing, which right. is when you dip the brush in the paint, in this case radium, and then you put it in your mouth and just sort of press it down with your lips to make that point finer. And they were doing this with radium. They were literally ingesting, like orally ingesting radium in their mouths, which means orally, and inviting cancer into their bodies unknowingly.
Yes, which is some pretty, I mean, that's not good. Like when you're ingesting the paint itself, apparently there was a guy who worked for Prudential, the insurance company. Back in 1925, he published a paper. His name was Frederick Hoffman. And he calculated that the radium girls who painted these watch faces, because of that lip pointing technique, they were ingesting something like 1¾ grams of this paint every day.
That's a lot of money.
They had to lip point so much. It is a lot of money. From the viewpoint of the factory owners, you'd think they would have been like, no, we got to stop that, because that is a lot of paint. But that's also a lot of radium that they were taking in too. And the big problem with that is not just that, you know, it's getting inside of you now and it's burning a hole right through you. It's not really doing that. Radium is an alkali earth metal. And it just so happens that calcium is also an alkali earth metal.
Yeah.
And to your bones, they're the same thing. Your body doesn't differentiate between the two. And our bodies are set up to divert calcium basically from the bloodstream right to the bones to help build strong bones, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we do the same thing with radium, too. Our bodies do. So when you ingest radium, it enters your bloodstream and it goes right to your bones and it sets about screwing you up big time from that point on.
Yeah, and apparently some of these young women were saying, you know, they were asking questions early on. They were saying, like, is this bad for you? Can it hurt you? And the, you know, the U.S. Radium Corporation was, I mean, they started covering up very early what was going on. They were doing their own research, and they said, and of course the people that were making that radium water did the same thing. They would hire out these private companies to do this research, basically, and say, everything's fine. And they mm-hmm. said, you know, ingesting a little bit is just fine. It'll put a little rose in your cheek, and it's great. And I guess they just sort of full stop there. They didn't talk much about how much ingesting a gram every time you did that over time would be, like over a period of years. Right. I think in 1916, they put out their own publication from the Radium Publishing Company that said, the physiological action of radium sounds not unlike a fairy tale.
Right. Which is weird. And they said that the red blood cell count surges. So you will actually kind of seem a little healthier. I couldn't find that anywhere. From what I saw, it causes hemolysis, which is like the rupturing of red blood cells. But this is the kind of stuff that, like, these publications were peddling, and doctors and the public were just taking it wholesale. And that was where that idea that radium was good for you came from, was from publications from people like the Radium Publishing Company. There was just a lot of credulity at the time, I guess, which is weird because this is also, like, one of the most avaricious periods in American history as well.
What does that mean?
It means that, like, people were preying on other people for profit and money, that, like, that you would do anything for a dollar, you know?
Okay.
Avarice.
Oh, okay. Makes sense now. I'm a little, like, I have COVID. Active, take it easy on me.
I will, man. I'll let that one slide. And I don't know if I've said this or not. I know Jerry wouldn't. but we're really glad you're doing good.
And it's funny, in that factory, they didn't say anything about the fact that, like, oh, you know, can this be dangerous? Because I've noticed all the men that are working around radium are wearing these big lead smocks and aprons, and they're handling this stuff with ivory-tipped tongs. What's the, and we're putting this in our mouth, and they're like, don't worry about that.
Yeah, and it wasn't – so at U.S. Radium in Orange, New Jersey, it was part of the corporate culture to basically just treat it really cavalierly. Like, even the head chemist, Edwin Lehman, who would pay dearly for his cavalierness, was recorded by an investigator who we'll talk about in a little bit as basically just handling lumps of radium or radium powder without any kind of gloves, no protection, no lead apron, anything, and just kind of just, you know, scoffing at the idea that it was, you know, dangerous. So, you know, some people there knew that it was dangerous and treated it so, but the corporate culture in that company in particular was that, you know, don't be ridiculous. Who cares? Stop talking. Stop asking questions, kind of thing.
Yeah, so this next part, I'm going to issue a trigger warning because it certainly got me with my tooth fears. Mm-hmm. So if you have dental fears and tooth fears, just be warned. This is from Kate Moore's book, and it's about the very first, I think the first young woman to fall ill at the USRC. Her name was Molly, I don't know if it's Magia or Magia. Mm-hmm. And this was in 1922. She was 24 years old. She said she felt like she was about 90. She had this really, I mean, she ached all over, but she had this pain in her lower jaw specifically. And then eventually went to the dentist, had these abscesses that were just oozing in her mouth. And her dentist tried to pull some of her teeth that were rotting, and a part of her jaw literally came out. And it says in the book, he removed it not by an operation, but merely by putting his fingers in the mouth and lifting it out. And I think a few days later, took out her entire lower jaw the same way, just pulled it out of her mouth.
Yes.
That's horrifying.
And if you have what's known as dentophobia, you are probably on the floor right now and may never go see a dentist again.
No, I hope no one listened to that.
It got me as well, man. When I was just like, this is so wrong. The crazy thing is Molly Magia, she lived for, I believe, another year or so with this increasing abscess. And like the radium was sitting in her bones, in this particular case, in her jaw, in her teeth, and just decaying the tissue around it, the bone around it. Ugh. And she just basically rotted from radiation poisoning from the inside of her jaw out. She suffered from abscesses and eventually died from an abscess. This abscess, apparently the whole left side of her face, the different abscesses grew into one mega abscess, and it finally reached her jugular vein and just ate away at her jugular vein, and she could no longer pump blood from her heart. Yeah, now I sound like I have COVID.
That is horrific as you can imagine, and it gets worse in that when her doctors were asked what their best guess was of the cause of death, they blamed it on syphilis.
Right.
The company jumps on this and says, and this was a big part of the movie, they basically start saying that these girls are spreading syphilis around each other, and that's what they're sick from. I think in the movie they called it VD, of course, but it was, you know, one part to sort of shame them into being quiet and to say that, and another part to just obviously, you know, take the blame as far away from radium as possible.
Men.
Yeah, for real.
So, you know, not to say in the doctor's defense, but no one knew what radium poisoning was at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe.
It's not like syphilis was an entirely, you know, just bonkers diagnosis. But there was another thing I saw that they considered too that just didn't make sense, but had kind of come and gone before among matchstick makers, which was something called phossy jaw or phosphorus jaw, where you're like, if you were exposed to white phosphorus, which matchmakers were when you're making the head of a match, It basically gets absorbed into your jaw and rots your jaw. So they had kind of seen something like this before, but not since like the early 19th century. It was much more prevalent in the 18th century. And they didn't think that these women were working with phosphorus anyway. So it was kind of baffling. But yeah, the idea that you know, even if the doctor did naively or innocently, you know, say it was syphilis or something like that, the company very much jumped on that kind of thing to use it to paint that a unflattering picture of the women who would go on to litigate this company. And it was totally that kind of a company. And it was run by those kind of people, for sure. U.S. Dial was.
Yeah, so 12, up to this point, 12 of them died. I think about 50 of them were ill at this point. And they are still full steam ahead. They don't halt production at all. No. They don't even call for an investigation until 1924, when it leaks out to the press a little bit, and they start to get, you know, some sort of bad press about what might be going on. So they commissioned an independent investigation that found out that there was definitely a connection going on, and that their exposure to radium is leading to these illnesses and deaths, and mm-hmm. they buried it and got their own not independent commission together. They investigated and came back and said, oh, no, these young ladies are suffering from a hysterical condition brought on by coincidence.
Yeah, and that was actually not even like a panel's opinion. That was Arthur Roeder, the president of U.S. Dial.
That was his opinion.
Yeah, that was his opinion of the whole thing. And that independent investigation was a legitimately independent investigation. It was led by Dr. Cecil Drinker and his wife, Dr. Catherine Drinker, who are both Harvard public health professors. And when they came up with these findings, like, yeah, these women are all dying horrible deaths from radiation poisoning, from eating this paint because of this stupid lip pointing technique, and the company did bury it. Not only did they bury it, it's even worse than that. They took the Drinker's report and altered it so that it said that every girl is in perfect condition, and then submitted it with the Drinker's name on it to the New Jersey Labor Department. And the Drinkers had no idea. They also told the Drinkers if they published their initial report, they would sue them, that they'd been working confidentially. And like I was saying, like, it was just that kind of company. They would engage in dirty tricks. They would do some of the most underhanded stuff you can imagine. I've got one more anecdote, Chuck. This is going to knock your socks off. They hired an industrial toxicologist named Frederick Flynn from Columbia to basically pose as a doctor to examine one of the Dial painters, and basically tell her that her health was fine. She was in fine shape. And they had a VP from U.S. Dial sit in and make it seem like he was a colleague of this person who she thought was a doctor, who emphatically agreed and backed up his position. That's the kind of stuff U.S. Dial did.
Reprehensible.
Agreed, Chuck. Agreed.
All right. So we should probably take another break, and we'll talk about how everything changed a little bit right after this.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so everything changed when a man got sick. And that's basically the way it went. In 1925, a 36-year-old chemist at USRC died of anemia. And the Essex County Health Examiner, a guy that'll figure in pretty prominently here going forward, Dr. Harrison Martland, got involved. And, you know, this is what it took. It took a man dying for them to sit up and pay attention. He launched an investigation. It was very sneaky, actually. He actually secretly recruited the technical director from USRC as a radiation expert. And his name was, this is one of the best names we've ever said on the show, Dr. Sabin A. von Sakaki. And they took autopsied tissue from some of the bone from these young women who had died, or I'm sorry, from the original chemist, and they analyzed it, and they said, yeah, he is basically glowing with radiation.
Yeah, I have to say also, Dr. von Sakaki, he was even more than just the technical director. He was the co-founder of US Radium, and he actually created the radium paint, Undark, that the company used. So the idea of him basically turning on the company in order to get to the bottom of, you know, what was going on, I think that's pretty commendable in that sense.
It is. He and Martland got a Geiger counter. I think it was sort of a early crude version, basically. And they started going around to the houses and in the hospitals where some of these young women were, and everything was radioactive. They tested employees at the plant that even weren't sick. They were radioactive. Basically, everyone that worked there was radioactive, including von Sakaki himself. He breathed into the thing, and I think he registered the highest radioactive level of everybody and died within a few years from jaw cancer.
Yeah, at age 45. And from what I saw also, if you took a Geiger counter to the gravesite of these people who worked at these factories, still today, the Geiger counter would measure, would set off. It would be set off by the radioactivity coming from six feet of earth separating you and the remains. Isn't that nuts?
Dude, it will do that for 1,000 years.
Wow.
And supposedly the bodies are still glowing underground.
I saw that one woman who worked at another one we'll talk about, Radium Dial Company. She was exhumed to be examined for, I think, a lawsuit later on. And they found that she was so radioactive that when they reburied her, they buried her in a lead-lined coffin.
Yeah.
I mean, this is super radioactive, right?
I think we've established that.
It's just hard to wrap your mind around how radioactive these people were. And it's crazy that they even live, some of them live for, you know, a few more years. Like Molly Maggia, she died pretty quickly. The woman whose jaw came out, she died within a couple of years. Some women lasted 4, 5, 6, even 7 years possibly. And the amount of radiation they were exposed to and the effects that it had on their body made, from the time they got sick to the time they died, just basically like a living hell. And the fact that they're still radioactive today, it really kind of drives home like how painful that must have been for them. Because apparently bone pain is not, it's not like regular pain at all. Like, you know, if your muscle hurts or joint hurts, you can just kind of like move your arm or something and it starts to feel a little bit better. With bone pain, you can't do that. Nothing makes it feel better. It's just like constant pain. And that's what you get when you have radium in your bones.
So five of these women got together that were still living, obviously, and went to court, or they didn't go to court right away. It took a long time. It took a long time for them to get enough money together to hire attorneys because there wasn't anyone initially who would take these cases pro bono. And so it took years to raise the money to do this. And one of the woman's name was Grace Fryer. She was basically the leader of the factory workers, and she had to wear a back brace because her spine had basically rotted out from the inside and was crushed. She had at least 20 surgeries on her jaw. Another woman's name was Albina Larice. She had 2 stillbirths and couldn't walk. Another woman was Catherine Schaub. She, I think her cousin died, was another fellow worker there. And so they were like, we have to do something here. They were, you know, they had all these medical bills. They couldn't even basically pay rent. And finally, after a couple of years, managed to find an attorney who would take it on pro bono. And, you know, they knew they didn't have long to live at this point. And it's not like they wanted some windfall of money. They just wanted to get by until they died. And they wanted to make sure that this didn't happen again.
Yeah. And again, this is like new stuff, basically, where workers are like, these were unsafe working conditions. We're going to sue our employer. This is pretty like groundbreaking. So initially, the women asked for, I think, $250,000 apiece, each for all five of them. And their lawyer, Raymond Berry, he apparently was a really good lawyer and really kind of fought the good fight for them. And one of the ways that they were ultimately successful, because it's kind of an understatement to say that U.S. Radium fought this lawsuit rather than settling, was that they recruited the press, basically. And in particular, the editor of the New York World, a guy named Walter Lippmann, took up this cause. And like, you know, at the time, the New York newspapers were like the most important media organizations in the world. And the New York World was like one of the bigger ones. So it was like, you know, it was having like all of the 24-hour news networks on your side, drumming up public support for your cause. And that really helped them. But even in the end, they didn't get anything even remotely close to that $250,000 they were asking for.
So what the Radium Corporation did at first was they said, you know, in New Jersey, the law says that we only have to pay you anything if it's within the first 2 years of your exposure. And because it took so long for them to raise this money, it was beyond that point, mm-hmm. which is just a pretty vile thing to do, obviously. Mm-hmm. Eventually, they settled for $10,000 each plus $600 a year for when they were alive, which was only a few years for each of them. I think within 5 years, all of them had passed away. It was later exposed that the judge in the case was a stakeholder in USRC.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Which is really pretty dirty, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then I think by 51, 30 years later, 41 of those original painters had died from different cancers.
Yeah, not a single one of the original five litigants from the lawsuit made it past age 38. And that's like, you have, by the way, a 0.1% lifetime risk of developing bone cancer. Bone cancer is really rare. Like, you can get cancer in your bones if you have a different cancer that spreads to your bones. But to start out with bone cancer, like many of these women did, it's incredibly rare. So the idea of a cluster of them all happening in this one factory and the company having nothing to do with it was preposterous. So the fact that they just got to settle for $10,000 per woman was actually kind of a coup. But one of the things that the initial five Radium girls were fighting for was to create awareness that, like, this is dangerous. And there's other women out there in the country and in the world who are doing the same thing, eating radium paint every day, and we want this to stop. And it actually did have that effect, that knock-on effect, and not one, but, Chuck, as you told me before, to my astoundment, two other cases where companies were basically forced to settle, and eventually radium paint was driven out of use.
Yeah, the other one, or one of the other two, was the Radium Doll Factory that we mentioned earlier in Ottawa, mm-hmm. Illinois. And, you know, I don't know if you can rank, like, which ones were more gross and dirty and awful, but Radium Doll, they actually did know what was going on the whole time for years. They had been testing their employees. They had doctors coming in, and they were giving them annual physicals, and they were recording radiation levels. And they just never told them, basically. I think before they went and filed that lawsuit, they were just suppressing information, burying everything they could. Mm-hmm. They even did autopsies and then tampered with those autopsies. I think that's what you were mentioning earlier, was that the other company did that too.
Mm-hmm. And they also lucked out by having an amazing lawyer too. They were led by two women, Catherine Wolfe Donahue and Charlotte Nevins Purcell, kind of took the lead for the lawsuit against Radium Doll. And this is, you know, years after this had made like the national press, the U.S. radium lawsuit, like it was a, everybody was talking about it. And for years, some companies managed to avoid any kind of culpability. And finally, Donahue and Purcell, with the help of their lawyer, Leonard Grossman, filed lawsuit against Radium Dial. They tried some underhanded stuff themselves, in addition to the whole autopsy thing. But once they were found out, they decided to shut down and then reopen in New York as a different company. And they said, oh, yeah, that other company was terrible, but it doesn't exist anymore. We're a new company now, so forget that lawsuit. And they were ruled against and were held accountable still.
Yeah, and obviously, like you mentioned, because of all of this, it was a very big deal for this country as far as workers' rights, safety in the workplace. Mm-hmm. It kind of directly led, it took a long time, but it kind of directly led to the forming of OSHA, yeah, which was a big deal. I think it directly led in 1938 to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And of course, this was for the public at large, so we weren't ingesting stuff like that in our cosmetics, but it also protected workers who were putting that stuff in the cosmetics.
Mm-hmm. Years after the public was protected, for sure. But yeah, it definitely had like a real impact and a real effect on the world. One of the things I saw, though, about Radium Dial Corporation's headquarters, it was finally demolished in 1968 in Ottawa, Illinois. And the town used the like rubble as backfill and landfill around the town. So now there's 16 radioactive Superfund sites around poor little Ottawa, Illinois, that the EPA's dealing with cleaning up and is causing all sorts of problems for the residents of the town. So it was like this one big problem, and then they spread it out all over town when they used the rubble.
Yeah, not super fun. Super fun. Yeah,
there's a really important D on the end of that.
Got to really overpronounce that D.
Agreed. You got anything else about the Radium Girls?
I don't. I mean, the movie's on Netflix. You can check it out. It's
it's a little late to endorse it now.
Well, I mean, it's not terrible. I think on Rotten Tomatoes, it had like a 70-something, but okay. It just critically wasn't well-reviewed and also not by me.
I see. I get you. Well, since Chuck said also not by me, of course, everyone, that means it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this a Nashvillian's response to the Grand Ole Opry show. Hey, guys, just want to give you a shout out about how much this native Nashvillian enjoyed your episode about the Grand Ole Opry. I grew up hearing about the Ryman's perfect acoustics and stories of country stars drinking at Tootsie's Bar behind the Opry until it was time to go on stage and running through the aligning back doors. My first job was actually at Opryland Theme Park. Oh, wow. I wonder if we met. It was at the water ride in the Flume Zoom. I think I do remember you, Camille. Immediately across us was the Porter Wagner stage, and Mr. Wagner himself performed every Friday. I now live in Chicago, and honestly, it's a little hard to visit Nashville since it's become a destination hotspot for bachelor and bachelorette parties. I didn't know that. Did you know that?
I didn't either. No, it makes sense, though.
I mean, I know that's where you had your bachelor party. I'll never forget that night.
Sure, Nashville.
It's crazy. plus, skyrocketing rents and new developments have pushed out a lot of locals and mom-and-pop businesses. Future episode recommendation, Repercussions of Being an It City. But listening to your episode reminded me of the quirky little city I grew up in. Plus, I learned some cool facts about the Opry I didn't know. Longtime fan, that is Camille McCarthy.
That is high praise coming from a... But OG Nashvillian, you know?
Yeah, and Camille also responded when I told her it was going to be on listener mail with a big woohoo. You guys are awesome. I just snuck out your Venus episode while grocery shopping.
Fantastic. Well, thanks a lot, Camille. Appreciate that. Hope you got some good groceries. Hope you wore a mask while you went grocery shopping, and I hope you're vaccinated.
Nice full circle there.
Yeah. If you want to get in touch with me, Chuck, Jerry, Chuck's COVID, whatever, you can write us all an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene Fodor.
Gene, was good.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano. Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.